Well, I want to focus actually on not so strong fields for my personal taste. So, because I want to focus on our work on other secondary collisions, which involves well, it's moderately strong fields. That's why I wrote only strong. But compared to the average, I guess here it's probably also super strong. So I will also move to theory, and compared to the previous talk, obviously the fields will be a lot stronger. So just to quantify this a little bit, we start here basically be interested in intensity starting up at 10 to the 16 watt per centimeter squared, and this is an intensity where the velocity of the electron in that laser field is not negligible anymore to the velocity of light, so that the magnetic field component of the laser field becomes of significant. Then at 10 to the 18 watt per centimeter squared, we are in the fully relativistic regime for optical frequencies, and things like spin and the mass shift and Zitterbewegung and so on are of importance. And then in the second part of my talk, I will indeed go to super strong fields starting at 10 to the 20 watt per centimeter square, and I will, since yesterday, we have been talking already about critical electric fields, I will mention this also briefly. This is what I would call super strong laser field involving 10 to the 29 watt per centimeter squared. Okay, so I will give you a brief introduction into the relativistic quantum dynamics, showing you a typical relativistic scattering scenarios where the timescales of the scatterings are obviously in the attosecond regimes are very, very short. And then we'll put some emphasis on relativistic recollisions. And one idea involving attosecond recollisions by shaping the laser beam such that we do have a relativistic recollision in spite of the magnetic field path, and what turned out that the best effect is to use attosecond trains. So that involves for us moderately strong laser fields of 10 to the 18, 10 to the 19 watts per centimeter squared. In the second half of my talk, I will indeed go to higher intensities where we have the quantum electrodynamical effects, vacuum non-linearity, something like index of refraction of vacuum, and harmonic generation in vacuum, and then move towards nuclear and high-energy physics with strong laser fields. One example will be nuclear excitation with the new XFEL sources in Hamburg, and at the end I will finish with muon production from laser-driven positronium as an example for particle physics with strong laser fields. So the first part of my talk involves the solution of the Dirac equation, where we do the quantum dynamics with those strong laser fields. Just to give you an idea, as compared to the Schrödinger equation, this is a bit more complex because we need bigger grids, obviously, because the particle moves far distances, but also to resolve those high energies and high momenta, we need smaller step sizes in space and time. There are alternative approaches in a relativistic regime using the Frank-Holler equation, or if you are moderately relativistic, the non-dipole regime, you can use also the Schrödinger equation beyond the Doppler approximation, or very successfully also semi-classical approaches in the relativistic regime when those intrinsic quantum effects such as spin and quantum interference do not play such an important role. This depends on the problem which approach you should use. So let me start just simply moving on to the scattering scenarios of the first quantum relativistic dynamics. So here you have two ions. This is a wave packet, an electron wave packet in a super strong laser field coming from here. You see this is a numerical grid. It's adapting in size and moving with the particle. And you see here that you can have effects such as quantum interferences when those wave packets are scattering. In the relativistic regime, those time scales are very short. This is an example of relativistic quantum dynamics. If you move to a more complex system involving more ions, then the wave packet evolves into a quite complex scenario. However, you could use this structure to get information about the ensemble where the scattering has taken place. So this is one example of scattering with ultra-intense strong magnetic fields. I want to put a bit more emphasis on the bound dynamics, the bound tunneling recollision dynamics in strong laser fields. Imagine here you have a bound single electron wave packet in a Coulombian potential, for example, multiply or highly charged ion. Then you have potentially the tunneling recollision scenario as we know in the non-relativistic regime, however, with one change. So after the tunneling, the wave packet sees the super strong laser field, and it, due to the magnetic field, there may be a drift in the forward direction. You can also explain this in terms of momentum transfer due to the incoming photon. So many people have been worrying about this, how we can get this electron come back, because it's obviously interesting if the electron comes back with a lot of energy, and we can have all these things we know with much higher energies. We can get more harmonics, we can get ADI with more energy, we can have non-sequential double ionization in the relativistic regime, we can have nuclear reactions if the particle come back with MEV energies and so on. So there's obviously interest in having this to come back. So the first thing I want to show is that in the moderately relativistic, so mildly relativistic regime, the drift is not so big that the effect is not there anymore. It will have some drift, however, the wave packet due to its spreading will still encounter the core, as you would see in the following transparency. Here, this is the center of mass motion of this tunnel wave packet around the nucleus. Sorry, this is deformed. You see there is some motion in the propagation direction, however, the wave packet still comes back, and due to the sort of spreading, it will hit the nucleus. And you can, for example, here see harmonic generation up to the sub-angstrom regime. This is for 10 to the 18 watts per centimeter squared. However, if you go to higher intensities and higher charges of the ion, then the yields become smaller and smaller. So one has to think about this. So this is summed up here. So in the fully relativistic regime, we have do have this problem of the Lorentz drift, which is seriously deadly if we just use the atoms and have laser fields and not anything fancy with it. Then it will miss the nucleus. So let's see what are the ideas which are on the market at the moment. One idea is to avoid this magnetic drift, is to pre-accelerate the ion against the laser field. If the ion moves against the laser field, it sees a redshifted frequency. And the drift depends strongly on the frequency. It scales with omega to the 3, and the drift will be smaller. If the frequency seen by the ion is redshifted, then we can get rid of the drift. Obviously, also the electric fields will be modified. However, the scaling is different. So we can have in principle an effective recollision if you have a significant pre-acceleration of the ion. The second idea, well, in the same year, 2004, saying, okay, we don't worry about the drift of the electron. We make the nucleus or the core also drift to move with the electron. For that, we need to have the core with the same mass. And this is the case for positronium. So instead of using atoms, use positronium. Then both the electron and the positron will move, and they will also hit each other. And we still have a relativistic encounter. The last solution, very nice, is using changing the fields, having two counter-propagating laser beams with the counter-rotating circular polarization, like depicted here. And the magnetic and electric field are parallel, and it will not harm. So the things we want to suggest here is, because we are here in an ultrasecond workshop, is we want to shape the field. So we're thinking is like, okay, if we start with the sinusoidal field, maybe if we shape this field, the magnetic recollision will be smaller or will go away completely. And what turned out later is that the ultrasecond pulses are the best way to proceed here. However, we initially started just with shaping the pulse, tailoring the pulse. So what we need here for an optimally shaped pulse, what we want is after ionization is, because usually after ionization there's a long time and then there's a recollision. And what we this long time in principle has only disadvantages, because during this long time the magnetic field will drift the electron in forward direction. So what we want is a strong decrease of the laser field after the phase of ionization. This is what we like the pulse to have. Then during this long time before the recollision, we want the field to be quite small, have a non-relativistic velocity, so that the magnetic field cannot push the electron in the forward direction. And then finally, we want again a strong field which pushes the electron back to the core, such that we have recollisions in the relativistic regime. So this concentration of the acceleration in a short time interval. So you quite clearly see from here already that what we like here is the train of our second pulses. So this is the optimal pulse has turned out to be not the sinusoidal. However, a pulse that where we have the ionization like here, then there's a long time where we have nothing, and then there's again a burst where the wave packet comes back to the nucleus. So during this time, there's no time for the drift to transfer the electron away. This looks a bit funny here, and this is because we restricted the pulse in the friction domain to be restricted by maximum number of harmonics. So we didn't want not to have more than 100 harmonics, because otherwise the pulse would be difficult to shape and to produce. Okay, so what we have calculated now by moving from the sinusoidal pulse to not a second pulse train is now we calculated the harmonic spectra as one example to show that these relativistic recollisions are much more efficient if you use anti-second pulses. So what we compare here is a spectra. Once we work in always the same parameters, of course, 10 to the 18 moles per centimeter squared, and sort of a 1 micron wavelength. And so first we do the calculation, not doing the Doppler approximation, in the Doppler approximation. Then of course the magnetic field is not there, and we get cut off quite far away. Then we do the relativistic solution. This is here, where we have the magnetic field, and this pushes the electron far away. There's sufficiently, effectively, no recollision, so the yield is very small. And then we use the attosecond train with the same average intensity. Then we find the cutoff is not so far away, because of course we still have this the mass shift, which pushes the cutoff to a lower value. However, the yield is much higher, because here we have a more efficient recollision. If you go to a higher intensity, 10 to the 19 here, then we see we have essentially the same yield as in the case where we do the Doppler approximation. However, of course, a smaller cutoff because of the mesh, which is not, you cannot avoid it because it's obviously not correct. So with the other second pulse, we can have quite high yield for the collision. Okay, let me now move to the second part. Yes? Yeah? Oh, yeah, I changed it. This is good that you mentioned this. This is the IP. From this IP, you can see we use multiply charged ions. So there's always some always an optimal ion to use. And it also increases the harmonic yield. Yeah, this 3UP will of course be adapted because we're in a relativistic. This would be
A is
3UP. But the relativistic energy with the gamma is the gamma factor with the relativistic gamma. Yes. The 3 point is somewhat modified. It's not. This is a non-relativistic calculation of 3.15. It's not exactly the same. Okay. Now let's move to the QED regime to see what sort of physics we can have with those super intense laser fields we are expecting and we are having partly already. Some ideas on the market. We know there's pair creation. involving pre-accelerated electrons towards 45 GeV. We also know this is an experiment. We know theoretically we have things like radiative reaction, that an electron which emits a photon could reabsorb this photon during the time the photon needs to escape the uncertainty area of the electron. So this is also something predicted some time ago. And I want to mention also that you could in principle have pair creation. We have heard this yesterday also, that's why I make it short. You can in principle have pair creation just with laser fields, not with pre-accelerated electrons. The picture we have seen yesterday, just want to remind you that you know, in the Dirac picture, if you have a strong laser field, it could tilt the, this is for electric field, of course, by Schwinger, but the electric or laser field could tilt this, this energy level such that from the Dirac particles could tunnel out to have, or negative to have positive energies. And this, the critical electric field is the Schwinger electric field corresponding to 10 to the 29 watt per centimeter squared. So the question I want to address here only in this topic is, can we see those pairs only with laser fields already at intensities much lower than 10 to the 29? Because there have been papers on this who claimed this. One paper claimed from Yerevan to claim 10 to the 18 watt per centimeter squared. So what we did is, as I want to show you only in this topic in the next movie, we looked at one of those electrons with negative energy in the Dirac sea, and look what happens to those particles when we apply strong cross laser fields. Cross laser fields are, this is what they claimed in that article, the likelihood for pair creation is much much better. So we looked at a cross laser field and look at the evolution of this electron, and what you should see in the next movie is to look for is there a likelihood that the wave packet while moving goes in the opposite direction. That means that the sign of the energy has changed, and this means that a pair has been born, the electron went from negative energy to positive energy. Now the first thing is for the 10 to the 18, where it has been claimed that we have pair creation. So we see from this particle with negative energy, it sort of nothing happens, just goes up and down. Now we move to the critical electric field, first a quarter, then a half. And we see if we have a quarter of the critical electric field, we see part of the Dirac wave packet splits off and moves in the opposite direction. And if it moves in the opposite direction, means that the sign of the energy has changed, this means that the pair has created. And if you go closer to the critical electric field, you see that the yields become significantly larger. So what we see is that for pair creation only with laser fields is that you should go to the critical electric field. But it's disappointing, however, we thought worthwhile looking at this. Okay. However, we think more encouraging there are effects where you could see QD effects with lasers at low intensities. So we looked at other vacuum nonlinearities, and particularly two. The first one is photon fusion, so harmonic generation in vacuum. So we have several photons, two lasers. So quite clear, we need more frequencies. So just such that energy momentum conservation is better fulfilled. So we started already with two lasers and looked at the likelihood of having harmonics just by using plain vacuum, right? And the second thing we were interested in is vacuum reflective index in the presence of the storm. So strong against standing fields, because we were expecting here to get that this is easier in this case. So if we apply a strong laser field, then we're looking at phase shifts of the applied probe field. And comparing, one could see by the interference structure if there has been a phase shift. So we do expect, of course, most of these effects to become more important when we go to the critical electric field. However, many things can be measured very sensitively. So we think that those effects could be seen in some cases earlier. That's what I want to show you now. So the first thing is harmonic generation in vacuum. This can be calculated straight straightforwardly by using the Euler-Heisenberg Lagrangian. So this is for the conceptual side, this is quite well known. Here, this was first very disappointing. If you look at this harmonic spectrum for a field which is sort of feasible at the moment, at the high end, 10 to the minus 4 critical, so 10 to the 21 watts per centimeter squared, you see quite disappointing, it goes down exponentially in a logarithmic scale. So only if we achieve those fields we heard yesterday may be feasible one day, you can have a plateau and a cutoff by plain vacuum. However, you have to go to a very strong intensity, 10 times this case, the critical electric field. So this is, of course, far away or never possible. However, we think if you look sort of at the fundamental, you see this, there's hope here. And what we thought of is photon-photon scattering. So photon-photon scattering, we think, may be possible. It has the highest yield. And what we estimated is if you have a sort of 30 terawatt, which is not so much, involving three lasers, so have two which are colliding, and then the third one which is probing the system, then one has a chance to be able to see this nonlinear effect. Okay. The second thing which I think is more likely to be seen is the direction of an X-ray probe beam with a strong standing laser field. So imagine now we have two cross laser fields which are strong and a probe beam, and what the probe beam wants to detect is if anything happens that is related to index refraction of the system. So tilting of the polarization or any induced ellipticity. So the calculation we have done involves diffraction. Since we have strong focusing, we need parameters such as the diffraction parameters here. Of course, very important is sort of the width, and both the probe field and the strong laser field. And very important is that this probe has high frequencies. So we're thinking here of using the XFEL device in Hamburg, because then the effect will turn out to be bigger. So how do we do it? We expect those effects just because we have vacuum fluctuations. In the strong laser fields, all those particles with negative energies will fluctuate and they will be strongly accelerated, and the acceleration will be nonlinear. So that's why you have also harmonics and so on. And the Hamilton operator, which describe, or in this case the Lagrangian, which describe this scenario, is the one given by the Euler-Heisenberg-Lagrangian. And it has this extra term here. This is the leading term, which is fine as approximation, as long as you are smaller than the critical electric field. And I think that can be done. Okay, from this Lagrangian, you can calculate the wave equation with those extra terms, and then go to the integral form and sort of get this extra integral here for the electric field after having passed the strong cross beam, strong cross beams. And you see that these extra terms are of the form of e to the cube. This is the strong laser field divided by e critical squared. So again, you could think, well, I mean, we have to be of the order of the critical electric field. However, not if we are able to measure the changes with high sensitivity, as you will see in a moment. So again, but the parameter to compare is still the critical electric field. Okay, so what do we get first if we describe the system with an refractive index? This is something which is known already. So you know that the index of refraction in the direction of the electric field is given by this form here, and if and perpendicular to the polarization of the cross beams, you get a different value. And this means that if you apply a probe beam with a particular polarization, you see that this linear polarization will go to a circular polarization. So you get elliptical polarization, a small ellipticity, and the small ellipticity is given by the difference of the two index refractions. This is if you neglect diffraction. If you include diffraction, as we have done, is you see that the applied probe field will not only lead to ellipticity, it will also be tilted by a small degree. And we have calculated how much this will be tilted, and this is given here as a function of the observation direction. And you see that both the polarization rotation and the ellipticity are roughly of the order of 10 to the minus 8. This is if you use laser fields of the order of 10 to the 23 watt per centimeter squared. So we tried on purpose to go well below. Of course, the effects are much bigger if you go to a stronger laser field, which is 10 to the 23. We get those numbers 10 to the minus 8, which sounds small. However, I want to recall here that there are experiments, the PFLAS experiments in Italy, who measure ellipticities and changes in the rotation and in the rotation of the polarization of the order of 10 to the minus 11. I mean, this is at least what they're working on and what they believe to see. I mean, it has not been done yet. However, they I think it's a quite well-known experiment. So it's not completely out of the completely impossible. And so we think those effects could be seen, particularly to be on the safe side. If you go a bit below, a bit above 10 to 25, we think that those rotations can be seen. Now I move to the last part. The question if we can see nuclear and high energy reactions, the first nuclear reactions. There's a lot of work on this already in the plasma community. We have seen that neutrons can be generated, for example, both with plasmas and also a bit more with clusters. So this is well known that this can be done. I want to address only two questions here. The first thing is, can we have tunneling recollision in a strong laser field such that the returning electron has any of the energies? The one example I've shown you already, by shaping the applied laser field to that we have artifacting pulse trains, then I think it is possible to have those recollisions in the MMV regime. And the other things I want to show you, just a movie, if you have a pre-accelerated ion, here in the rest frame of the ion, the laser field comes from here, if it's strongly accelerated against the laser field, then the frequency will be changed such that we have extremely short time scales. And you see this here in the snapshot. So by the time when the first half of the wave packet has sort of been ramped up already, the second part hasn't even seen the laser field yet. And such that we can have the first part already goes with MEV energies against the nucleus before we have ionization. The lasers you need here of the order of magnitude are 10 to the 20 watts per centimeter squared. However, you need strong pre-acceleration to TV energy. So you have to do this at LHC. If you don't want MEV energies, of course, you don't have to use such high injections. If you're happy with 100 keV, then moderate gammas are possible. The next thing we also were asking ourselves, can we have quantum optics with nuclear and strong laser fields? So can we have resonant interactions? So this is, I come from that community, so for me that's of course very exciting to see that at those high frequencies we can do similar things we all know from atoms. And we believe, particularly with the upcoming XFEL laser source in Hamburg, there is a realistic chance, the frequency higher, so we can also use a species with higher transition frequencies. So what we started off with is using systems such as radium and thorium with transition frequencies here of 50 keV and here of 180 keV. I've been also drawing here already three-level systems, so that's sort of a start for me for interesting quantum optics. However, the work I show here just involve very modest things like excitations. The question is how much can we have excitation here from the ground state to the excited state just by using XFAL sources. So the scenario shown here, here you have the XFAL, and here we have the nucleus, and we allow the nucleus to have a moderate pre-acceleration against the laser pulse, the XFAL pulse, such that we really get on resonance if the frequencies are not high enough. So we have compared this here with the Tesla, where the variables are shown here with what we have from the design report, what we hope they will eventually also do. So have 12.4 kV as a frequency, and laser fields between 10 to 16 and 10 to 20 watts per centimeter squared. This is, of course, optimistic. However, we think the writers in the design report, there are good chances it will be realized. So here, for those intensities, we still need a small, this is the resonance, it's sort of essentially the gamma factor. We need a small gamma of roughly 4, such that we have a resonance here with the XFAL pulse. And then also the intensities which we have will scale in the restrain of the particles. So the effective intensity can go up to 10 to the 21 watt per centimeter squared. And in this intensities, we looked at the excitation from the ground state to the excited state and have applied just well-known quantum optical calculations here. And what we see here for those intensities in the rest frame, we look at the population inversion, so the difference of population between the excited state and the ground state, so this minus this. And in the beginning, before the pulse starts, everything's in the ground state. And then we have something which we know in quantum optics as Rabi flopping, so the population can go up and down for the intensities which is feasible. It's a green line, 10 to 21. There is at least a small excitation of the ground state to the excited state. Okay, so we also in the calculation we included all the parameters we know from those nuclei. And what we have done most recently, coming up in future SC soon, is that we looked at the same process, however, involving very strong low frequency fields, rather than having XFE lights or using multiphoton. Thank you. Multiphoton processes. And here, this is less encouraging because the intensities you need are really very high. So I wouldn't dare to show this here. So very briefly, since I have only a few minutes left, is we have most recently looking at laser-driven high-energy processes. This is a work in process. It's not completely finished, or not finished. However, the first thing we have been calculating is we wanted to see if we can calculate such a Feynman diagram. So the collision of an electron and a positron, get a gamma photon, and we get a muon-antimuon pair. So a very traditional high-energy reaction in strong laser field. So all the things how you can calculate this are of course well-known in books. However, you have to use, instead of just electrons and positrons, you have to use Volkov states. So dressed particles, electrons and positrons dressed by the laser field. That makes the calculations, I'm afraid, more difficult. I think we are planning to do later, of course, is also more complex Feynman diagrams. So the first results. Why do we want to use actually a positronium gas? You know, there people know, we know already that there are, you know, things can happen. This collision can happen also in the plasma of electrons and positrons. However, in the plasma, there's incoherent collision. So the particles may miss each other. And you need quite high density to have a large yield. So for a small density, it's much better to use really positronium, where the electron and positron which you have separated come back to their own, you know, to their own partner they had before. So the luminosity which you calculated is much higher if you use a positronium gas, if you use this coherent mechanism rather than the plasma. That's why we started with this positronium gas. We also started using circularly polarized laser field, I have to confess. Even though it's quite clear that the yields are much smaller than for linearly polarized laser fields, or all the theorists here they anticipate that the Bessel function with the circular polarized laser fields are much more friendly than the ones with the linear polarization. So we started with this, and we got tiny here. So I have to admit this, 10 to the minus 3 per second, this is a ridiculously small. However, it was an exercise for us, and it's quite clear it's small because you can see here electron positron in a circular polarized laser field. They basically would chase each other. They don't hit each other. So the yield must be tiny. The only way they hit each other is if you have strong spreading. So the next thing we calculated is the same thing in the plasma, electron positron plasma there. The muon to muon yield is 10 to the 7 per second. Only if you assume a very large density of 10 to the 9 particles in a focal volume. The thing which is still under investigation, the most promising scenario is the interaction of a positronium gas with linear polarized laser field, where we anticipate, and this is particularly with Kerst Müller and my group, who, where we have good signs that the yields are higher than the ones in the plasma. And with this, I want to thank the involved group members. This is from last year, I'm afraid, but the key members are on the picture. First, retisticon dynamics. Karen Rotzen is very important with all those technical issues. In particular, Guido Mocken is the one who runs the movies, the VROC propagation, and written the code of the VROC equation. Then on the QED side, in the nuclear physics, Jörg Evers is the key person here. On the low energy side, I haven't shown much Ulrich and Schuhe currently. The last part in the high energy regime, Antonio Di Piazza is the one involved in the calculation of the vacuum nonlinearity, and Carsten Müller. Carsten, where you are? Here. Carsten has calculated the muon anti-muon pair creation. So laser field, very important, of course, also to PhD students who are here, Michael Kleiber and Mario Ferschel. Michael is the one who has done the calculations on the other second equilibrium. Thank you for your attention. Yes.
Mm-hmm. In the case of this nuclear transition you were talking about, driving in, I think, thorium or radium, I would think most of the photons that come in are going to ionize electrons rather than drive this transition. Do you have to strip off the electrons to do this experiment, or do enough photons get through the electron cloud to actually drive the nuclear transition?
Well, we have they are exactly on resonance. I mean, these photons. So there's a cross section. This resonance is a dominating feature here.
It's much larger than the photoionization of the inner shells.
That's. I think these involve several, two or three photons. I mean, I thought it was a lot weaker. This is my understanding. So I have to look into this again. But I think the ionization rate is quite small.
For the electrodynamics and the breakdown of vacuum and the nonlinearity of vacuum, you mentioned colliding pulses or cross beams, but you didn't mention particularly an angle or a polarization. Were you using circularly polarized light in that case?
Well, in this case, we used linear polarization. We used very high frequency. In fact, the time scale was quite small, and the drift didn't play such an important role. But in principle, the calculation, it was exactly at the point where the magnetic field doesn't play a role. So you could do similar things if you use the circular polarization with the opposite rotation. Then also the magnetic field doesn't play a role. In fact, in some situations, this is also better because it has focusing areas.
It's a very important aspect of the focusing.
The focusing is we have compared both, in general, very often the circular polarization is better. But it wasn't. I mean, in this case, I wanted only to emphasize that when the threshold, when it comes, but then when it starts, pair creation starts to play a big important role. So we didn't attempt here to have the quantitative results. We want to see what is the threshold of one pair equation created. Does it start at 10 to the 18? Does it start at 10 to the 21? So we haven't been worrying at those details at the moment.
I have a question for you. You say that the recollision should be suppressed, you know, in relativistic regime. And should we reappear in the ultra-relativistic regime where the ion will also move at the speed of light, where both the electrons and ion should move at the speed of light, should recollision reappear at that moment in this regime?
Mm-hmm. This is a good point. I mean, but they need to have the same mass. Of course, if the masses are different, then the sort of the momentum transfer in the forward direction will not be the same. They will both be
not exactly the same, but
for positronium, for example, I've shown you as an example of positronium, where the electron and the positron have the same mass, they both will be pushed in the forward direction. They will hit each other. Mm-hmm. If the mass is not the same, I think they will not.
Yeah, but in the ultra-relativistic regime.
The ultra-relativistic one, basically, they're all the same.
They're all the same.
Good point. Then it's a good point, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
Okay.
So, but then extremely obvious, yes.
Okay, I guess that's the last question. So let's thank Christoph for a very nice talk. And we move next from super strong to ultra intense.